On today's Your Call, we'll spend the hour with Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz, a daily newspaper in Israel. In a Guardian piece that ran last February, he wrote, quote, Israel's media operates under official censorship. That has been the basic fact of my professional life as a journalist covering foreign policy and national security, end quote. We'll talk about the media landscape and press freedom in Israel. We'll also talk about the differences between what we read in the U.S. press and the Israeli press about issues like settlements, occupation, and the BDS movement. What strikes you about coverage of these issues? Join us after the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. The Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych and opposition leaders have signed an agreement on ending the political crisis there. It's now been approved by the parliament. David Stern in Kiev reports.
Parliament voted by a wide margin to reintroduce the 2004 constitution, which balances power between the presidency and the legislature. This had been a key demand of the anti-government protest movement, but until now, deputies from the pro-government party had blocked its passing. A few hours before, Mr. Yanukovych and the three opposition leaders signed an agreement which they hope will end Ukraine's violence. This deal includes the formation of a national unity government within 10 days. Also, presidential elections are to take place no later than December.
The Ukrainian parliament has also voted to amend the criminal code, a move that could pave the way for the release of the jailed former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. The deal has been met with scepticism by some of the thousands of protesters who remain on Independence Square in Kiev. The European Union foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, said the implementation of the deal would be a key challenge. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said radical and extremist forces responsible for violence in Ukraine should be condemned. International mediators say the militant Basque separatist organisation ETA has released a video in which it says it started a process of putting its weapons beyond use. Here's James Robbins.
The pictures were recorded by ETA at a secret location. They show two masked ETA members dressed in black displaying on a table what's believed to be a small part of the weapons arsenal of the banned Basque separatist organisation. Two of the international team of verifiers check an inventory before signing it. They say these guns and explosives have now been put under seal and beyond use. They call it a hugely important first step. The video was handed to the BBC by an intermediary acting with full approval from the Amsterdam-based Verification Commission, which is trying to build on ETA's public commitment in 2011 to cease all armed activity.
Militants from the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab have attacked the presidential palace in the capital Mogadishu. The Somali president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, was unharmed. Richard Hamilton reports.
The attack began when a vehicle laden with explosives was rammed against the perimeter wall of the presidential palace. Militants wearing suicide vests and armed with guns and grenades then entered the complex as guards returned fire. On his Twitter account, the UN envoy to Somalia, Nick Kay, said President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud had phoned him to say he was unharmed and the attack had failed. The security minister, Abdi Karim Hussein, added that the situation was now under control, saying some of the attackers had been killed and others had been captured.
World News from the BBC. Human rights activists have condemned the decision by a court in Sudan to convict an Ethiopian migrant of indecent acts after she was gang-raped. The 18-year-old woman was 3 months pregnant at the time of the attack. She was arrested after video of her being sexually abused was circulated on social media. Three men who admitted having sex with her were sentenced to 100 lashes for adultery. Russian police say they've detained about 200 people outside a courthouse in Moscow, where 8 people were convicted for rioting at an opposition protest nearly 2 years ago. The 8 were found guilty of using violence against police officers at a protest before President Vladimir Putin's inauguration to a third term of office. Two athletes at the Sochi Winter Olympics have been disqualified after failing doping tests. Both tested positive for a banned stimulant. They've been expelled from the Games. Alex Kapstick, who's in Sochi, sent this report.
Evie Sakenbakis-Staley is a double Winter Olympic cross-country champion who had turned to the biathlon for these games, but she's failed a drug test. The 33-year-old German just missed out on a medal here in Sochi, finishing fourth in her race on Monday. She said she's done nothing wrong and is living in the worst nightmare. The second doping infringement involved an Italian bobsled athlete. William Frolani has been sent home with his event due to start on Saturday. Earlier this week, the IOC's chief medical officer said he was confident the testers were beating the cheats.
A leading Islamic body in the United Arab Emirates has issued a fatwa, or religious edict, prohibiting journeys to Mars because the clerics felt such a trip carried a risk to life. The General Authority of Islamic Affairs, based in Abu Dhabi, said embarking on a trip to Mars was tantamount to committing suicide, as it was not known how people could survive on the planet. The fatwa was issued after reports that several Muslims from the Gulf countries had signed up for a trip to Mars in 2024. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As a young journalist in the late 1980s, today's guest, Alouf Ben, wrote a critical story about the Mossad, Israel's national intelligence agency. His editor warned him, quote, "Do it in your free time. It'll never see the light of day anyway," end quote. Today, Alouf Ben says that Israel's media operates under official censorship. In a piece he wrote for The Guardian last February, he writes, quote, "That has been the basic fact of my professional life as a journalist covering foreign policy and national security. Here's how it works. Any story involving defense, intelligence, or nuclear matters must be submitted to the military censor's office. It can run only after being stamped for approval." End quote. On today's Your Call, we'll speak with Alouf Ben about the media landscape and press freedom in Israel. We'll also talk about the differences between what we read here in the United States and the Israeli press about issues like settlements, the BDS movement, the human cost of the occupation, and many other subjects. Alouf Ben serves as editor-in-chief of Haaretz, the daily newspaper in Israel. He's also served as the paper's diplomatic editor. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, and Newsweek. He's a regular contributor to The Guardian, and he's here in the United States for a week, and we're both currently at UC Berkeley Studios. Hi, Alouf.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for coming in. So the first line of the piece you wrote is that you're working under some pretty tough censorship. Israel's media operates under official censorship. What do you mean by that exactly?
It means that someone else, the government in this case, is reading your stories before you publish them. And, you know, Israel being Israel, it's not some faceless, scary bureaucrats operating behind walls. It's people you know. You can negotiate with them in a friendly atmosphere. But in the end of the day, it serves to mostly as a deterrent for not raising specific issues or for postponing the publication. It's not only that. When that doesn't work, you know, the censorship now operates under strict guidance by the Israeli Supreme Court based on an appeal about this Mossad story of mine from 25 years ago. And it says that they could block publication only if there's close certainty of grave harm to national security. So what the government has been doing is they don't even trust the censorship anymore, and they rely more and more on gag orders from courts, not only on security affairs, but also on police matters. So, you know, you have to fight these limits all the time.
What was the last fight you were engaged in?
The last fight was about a senior police officer who was blamed for misconduct regarding an informant of the police who was maimed or something like that. We don't even know the exact details. And the government paid this CI's family a large sum of money as compensation. And they were trying to block the publication of the story and not to implicate the senior police officer who has since then got promoted and is now one of the top two or three investigators in Israeli police, and we fought it through the Supreme Court, and we won, and the story came out.
What do you mean when you say friendly negotiations?
Friendly negotiations is, you know, like any other negotiation. You call someone from the censor's office, depending on the importance of the story, and you call each other by your first name, and you try to convince them to let it pass. Occasionally, it's not, you know, blocking an entire story is uncommon, because most of the time people know what not to even try to cross. Usually it's about certain details or certain wording. You know, you're not supposed to write nuclear weapons. If it's about Israel, you're supposed to write nuclear capabilities, whatever that is.
So there's an actual censor office?
Yes, there is, in a civilian office building in Tel Aviv.
So then, I mean, how do you...
It's a small unit. It's about 35 people all in all.
So this is almost like self-censorship. So what would happen if Haaretz wrote nuclear weapons?
Well, it depends on the context of the story. You know, there was a guy, a journalist not from Haaretz, from National TV, who wrote in a media criticism website, he wrote, "Israel has nuclear weapons, period. Now I want to see what will happen to me. You see, I said it. I said so. And guess what? Nothing happened."
Hmm.
Look, it's far lighter and easier than it used to be when I became a journalist years ago. At that time, the names of military officials were off limits. At that time, any mention of the security and intelligence services was very, very restricted. At that time, you didn't even write nuclear capabilities. Times are changing.
In the piece you wrote for The Guardian last year, you wrote, in most cases, the media lives with restrictions through quoting, foreign sources. At Haaretz, we can't write that Israel bombed a nuclear reactor or arms convoy in Syria, but if it's published in The Guardian, for example, it's fine.
Yeah, that's the usual way. Well, what happened in recent years, the Israeli government has changed its policy towards announcing military actions. Obviously, if there's a bombing in Gaza or they're arresting someone in Ramallah and everybody sees it, it's one thing. But if you fly late at night to some obscure location across the border and bomb something and come back, the idea was that it's a bad thing to boast about it. Why embarrass the neighboring government? Keep it secret. They would be able to save face and not retaliate and so on. So then these things come out through leaks of Pentagon officials or international media. So as long as you quote international media, there's no problem. And Israelis, you know, the readers, the listeners, the viewers in Israel, they know about these things.
How is the nuclear issue covered in Israel? There were a couple pieces recently. The New York Times had an op-ed called "Let's Be Honest About Israel's Nukes," basically saying President Obama always tries to sidestep this question, but he should be honest about it. And then The Guardian had a piece in it last month called "The Truth About Israel's Secret Nuclear Arsenal." It said, "Israel has been stealing nuclear secrets and covertly making bombs since the 1950s, and Western governments, including Britain and the U.S., turned a blind eye. How can we expect Iran to curb its nuclear ambitions if the Israelis won't come clean?" This is a piece by Julian Borger. So how do these issues get covered in Israel?
That kind of debate is pretty much free in Israel. Let's for the listeners who are less familiar with the subtleties of Israeli nuclear policy. Israel built its nuclear reactor in the late 50s, early 60s. It was supplied by the French government and for many years held in strict secrecy. In the mid-80s, Mordechai Vanunu, who worked there as a technician, brought a camera into the facility, and then after he was fired, he left Israel and he gave the story to the Sunday Times. And that indicated that Israel has an underground plutonium reprocessing facility from which as many as 200 nuclear bombs could have been built throughout the year. So this number, after the Vanunu story, this number became like the magic number assessment of Israel's nuclear arsenal. The official policy is ambiguity. Israel never said it had nukes. It never said it doesn't have them. And it's based on a long-standing understanding with the American government that as long as Israel keeps its lips tight about it, the U.S. will not pursue or force Israel to join the NPT and disarm whatever capabilities it might have. And there is an ongoing debate in Israel for many, many years about why should it be ambiguous? Why not come out of the open and declare it would improve deterrence and keep us out of this ambiguous situation? But I think that the Israeli public is overwhelmingly supportive of the nuclear option. It's been polled every year or so. And the ambiguity, you know, has been working. So why bother with it? But there are columnists even in Israel who argue that it's a wrong policy.
Are there constraints? Do you have constraints when it comes to covering nuclear weapons in Israel? And can you write about Mordechai Vanunu?
Yeah, we write about Vanunu all the time. The constraints are mostly about technical or operational matters or command and control issues. These are censored, but they are censored when it comes to conventional weapons as well. You know, you wouldn't publish the bombing capabilities of certain weapon systems in the Israeli Air Force arsenal. You wouldn't do it in America as well. Look, the main difference here, and this is where censorship allows you to live freely than many of our peers outside of Israel. Once you submit anything to censorship, you're freed from any responsibility to national security. And when I see my colleagues in the U.S. or Britain having to deal, for example, with the NSA revelations and the accusations that these publications might have harmed national security, or who put you in charge of deciding what might harm security or not, we are free, totally free from these dilemmas. Someone else, the censorship in that case, is doing it for us.
We're speaking with Aluf Ben, the editor-in-chief of Haaretz, a daily newspaper in Israel. He's also served as the paper's diplomatic editor. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, and Newsweek, and he's a regular contributor to The Guardian. And we're spending the hour with Aluf talking about press freedom in Israel and the country's censor's office. We'll also be talking about the differences between what we see here in the U.S. and Israel, about everything from the BDS movement and the human cost of the occupation, issues like settlement. If you have any questions or comments about these issues, if you have a question for Aluf, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So you've been the editor-in-chief of Haaretz since 2011, but you've been a journalist for the past two decades. Give us an overview of the media landscape in Israel.
I think it's pretty much like anywhere else. You have strong mainstream channels. I'm talking about the Hebrew language media in Israel. We have a very strong TV channel, which attracts most viewers. It's a commercial channel. And we have two major newspapers that are widely circulated. One is more critical today of Netanyahu and his government. But they try to present themselves as the voice of the Israeli mainstream, which they have been defining for decades now. And their main competition is Israel Hayom. It's a free paper established by Sheldon Adelson, who's an ardent supporter. It's an American and Chinese gambling magnate who's an ardent supporter of Netanyahu. And this paper serves more or less as the mouthpiece of Netanyahu and his office. You know, whenever some politician is in favor with the prime minister, they praise him, and the next day when he has a fallout with the prime minister, they write against him.
Well, and Sheldon Adelson, I mean, he spent $150 million during the 2012 campaign in the United States for Republican candidates. He was a huge supporter of bombing Iran.
Well, you know, you see, and it's not enough to bomb Iran, in fact. You know, $150 million doesn't buy you a bombing.
How many others like him finance newspapers in Israel?
No, there's nothing like it.
Nothing like him.
No, there's nothing like him. The other newspapers still try to live, you know, by selling subscriptions and advertising, and there are several smaller newspapers. Haaretz, my newspaper, is the liberal voice in Israel. It has been the liberal voice for decades. It was established at the end of the First World War, and since then it has been the critical liberal voice of society. And now we see a trend of the right wing having their own version of a more intelligent newspaper, where the mainstream position of that paper is supporting the settlements and opposing any criticism of the state and of the settlements and so on.
What is the difference between the English version of Haaretz and the Hebrew version?
It's different languages.
But in terms of the politics?
I don't think there's a difference in terms of the politics. Obviously, the coverage is different because most of the readers of the English language content are online readers who live outside of Israel, mostly in North America. And obviously to them, to you I would say, local crime stories or, I don't know, the teacher strike of tomorrow are less important. So usually the English website is more focused on politics, war and peace issues, regional affairs, and less on local cultural and domestic issues. In Hebrew, we devote huge resources to covering all aspects of culture. We're the only ones covering Hebrew culture in Israel. You know, dance, theater, classical music. Haaretz is the only voice of these arts in Israel.
We're speaking with Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz, and we have a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Regarding the peace process, what would you do with the 500,000 Jews currently residing on the West Bank?
Well, I think the obvious and pretty much mainstream idea about that is to draw a border, which would include most of these people in Israel proper, in return for land swaps given to the new Palestinian state, and those would remain behind or beyond the border of Israel will be relocated into Israel proper.
How does Haaretz cover the settlement issue? When you look at the numbers, since 1993, the settler population has doubled. 53,000 settler homes have been built. How does Haaretz cover that issue?
The usual way, with reporters on the ground. We have one reporter, Amira Haas, who lives in Ramallah and covers the occupation from the Palestinian viewpoint. And we have Chaim Levinson, who covers the settlements from the Israeli side. And We have some additional writers that look at settlement issues when it enters their beat. If it's, you know, it be environment or economic affairs or budget allocations, and obviously the military correspondents who cover the conflict, the violent aspects of the conflict, and it goes on and on. We have columnists and feature writers like Gideon Levy, who writes a weekly column about the occupation and its consequences. We devote, I would say, the largest amount of coverage to the occupation and settlements than any other media in Israel by far. And we've done that. You know, today the settlements and the peace process are once again major headlines in Israel and outside of Israel. Mm. But we devoted all these resources even when the issue was on the sidelines and people paid less attention. I think what we've seen in the past year is that the occupation issue is once again very much on the mind of everybody. And for many years, it wasn't the case.
Can your journalists freely go to the West Bank and Gaza? Amira Haas is, I think she's the only Israeli journalist, right, to have spent almost 20 years living in and reporting from the West Bank and Gaza?
Yes.
Can reporters freely move about?
No. If you want, Gaza is totally off limits to Israelis unless they have foreign passports. And then they have to go there through Egypt and coordinate it with Hamas or whatever. And not many, I think Amira was there about 4 or 5 years ago and maybe once more, but that's it.
So she's in the West Bank now?
She's in Ramallah. She holds a foreign passport, so she could enter. Mm-hmm. Israelis with Israeli passports are not allowed by the Israeli government, not by Hamas, to enter Gaza at all. They can move more freely in the West Bank, in the Palestinian areas. Again, the government doesn't allow Israeli Jews to enter the Palestinian areas for fear of for their lives, but it gives a carte blanche to journalists to do that.
So how do you get information out of Gaza?
you know, there are phone lines and emails and other media. There was some journalist, a Palestinian journalist in Gaza, who was writing for us occasionally. But I think she got into some trouble with Hamas for doing that.
Well, thanks again for calling in, Frank. Let's go to one more call before break. Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thank you. I visited Israel 4 times, and I'm hardly an expert, but I do understand the complexity of the situation as far as the West Bank. I've long supported a two-state solution. But if you think about Israel, you have to filter everything you think about Israel through the Holocaust. A two-state solution would be a viable full state for the Palestinians. That means they can have open borders, they can have a full-scale military, they can have air rights. It's for an Israeli, I believe it's a fear. It's simply a fear. I don't see any other solution than a two-state solution, but I can understand Israelis' problems. If you try to control another people, it becomes like apartheid. It didn't work in South Africa, and it won't work in Israel. But I have great sympathy for Israelis, and I really like that country a lot. And I like the Palestinians I met there. So, like everyone else, it's a very hard problem to resolve. Thank you.
Of course. Well, you know, obviously it's a very hard problem to resolve, and that's why it hasn't been resolved for so many years, and that's why even the current John Kerry peace mission is pretty much in doubt. But it doesn't mean we should not try. And obviously the choice here is between taking different risks. It's not between zero risk and full risk of the status quo. The status quo has its advantages for Israelis, because in the past several years, most of the time in the West Bank and Israel, there were very few terrorist attacks. Israelis live pretty quietly. But as you said, you cannot control other people forever, and because that raises questions about your democracy. So yes, Israel will have to take some risks, and so will the Palestinians. And no peace or no agreement or no deal is ever sealed. You have to maintain it. You have to maintain it through deterrence. You have to maintain it through security cooperation. You have to maintain it through tense adversity, but each side recognizing its limits, like the situation we've had with Syria and Lebanon. There are no easy ways out here. It's not going to even a peace treaty supported by both peoples will not turn Israel and the Palestinians into Benelux or Sweden and Norway tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program. I read Haaretz occasionally. I always enjoy it because it seems to cover things of interest to Americans that we don't read in the American press. I see much more freedom there. Anyway, I have 2 questions. One has to do with the current status of relations between Israel and the new government in Egypt. And 2, I read recently in The Guardian that the Spanish government has agreed to give passports to the descendants of Jews that were expelled 500 years ago or so. And how was that discussed in the Israeli press? And I'll ask a difficult question. Has that raised issues about the status of Palestinians that were forced to leave their country, their homeland? Thank you very much. I'll take your answer on the air. Thank you.
Regarding the Spanish offer of passports, of citizenship, it got lots of publicity in Israel. It happened, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And although it's still pending final approval in the Spanish parliament or something like that, you know, Israelis are always psyched about being accepted by the outside world. And the idea that hundreds of thousands of Israelis or even more would become European citizens obviously raised a lot of interest. So far, the way we understand it, it's still pending. It's still unclear under what conditions. How can you even show that your family was displaced from Spain over 500 years ago?
And Alouf, hold that thought. We'll continue talking about this issue right after the break. We have to take a short break. We're speaking with Alouf Ben. He's editor-in-chief of Haaretz, a daily liberal newspaper in Israel. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call on KALW Local Public Radio to join in today's conversation. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices on your call. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And all of the stories discussed on the weekly media roundtable today will also be posted at the Your Call radio.org website a little later on this morning. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with David Robinson Simon about his new book, Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. We're going to talk about the big players in the meat and dairy industries and find out about the economics in these massive industries. That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are spending the hour with Alouf Ben. He's editor-in-chief of Haaretz, the daily liberal newspaper in Israel. He's here in the United States giving talks. And right now we're both in Berkeley. We're talking about everything from censorship in Israel. He says Israel's media operates under official censorship. There's a censor office that journalists have to speak to on a regular basis. And then we're also talking about the differences between what we see here in the United States press and the Israeli press about things we've already discussed. The occupation, settlements. We'll also talk about the boycott divestment movement. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So you were talking before the break about Max's question about the Spanish government giving passports.
Yeah, well, you know, many Israelis with European descent have applied and received passports from their ancestral homelands like Poland, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. They're all members of the EU, and obviously that passport allows you to live and work anywhere you want within the EU. So the Spanish offer is just the latest in a wave of this dual nationality offers to Israelis, but it has nothing to do with the issue of Palestinians. And the first time I even heard the linkage between that and the Palestinians was in Max's question. Now, regarding Egypt, as we all know, has been through political turmoil in the past 3 years. And for many years, President Mubarak was one of the most important, if not the key strategic partner of Israel in the Middle East. Not out of Zionism. He was not a Zionist. He refused to pay an official visit to Israel, but out of mutual interest. And when he had to leave, there was a growing fear in Israel of Egypt becoming Iran next door. Because older Israelis remembered how in the 70s the Shah of Iran was Israel's closest ally in the Middle East. And almost overnight, he was replaced by a very hostile Islamic government. That didn't happen in Egypt. On the contrary, in the past 3 years, both Israel and Egypt have done, paid considerable attention and energy to preserve the strategic alliance, even when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt. And obviously, even more so with the return of the generals under General Sisi. We don't have high-level official meetings anymore, and trade has dried up, and the Egyptians will not give visas to Israelis to visit. But the relationship between the governments and the security and intelligence organs, I think, are the best ever. in terms of joining forces to combat terrorism in the Sinai, joining forces to put pressure on Hamas in Gaza, to impose the ceasefire in Gaza, and so on.
I wanted to ask you also about a report in Haaretz today called U.S. Investigates Illegal Military Equipment Shipments from Israel to Iran. I know that you've been traveling, so you're not that familiar with this, but we talked about this before. The lead says Israeli arms dealers twice tried to send spare parts for fighter planes to Iran, the Telegraph has established, flouting an international arms embargo and openly contradicting the bitter enmity between the Jewish state and the Islamic regime.
Well, you know, people sometimes want to make money, and when the customer is desperate, you're usually making more money. I don't think it has to do with any geopolitical considerations or they were trying these people. If these allegations are true and so on and so forth, that these people were trying to challenge the international embargo, they were trying to make a buck. And, you know, sometimes people disobey their government's policies on these matters.
It says Israeli media carried only brief versions of this report, suggesting that the matter may be subject to the country's strict military censorship.
It might. Unfortunately, I'm less familiar with the details here, so I can't really get into them. I'll have to check.
Yeah. How? I mean, this reporter is Menelios.
It happened before in the 90s. A very well-known person in Israel called Nachum Manbar was also the owner of one of the country's top basketball teams. He was a businessman, and he was convicted for selling chemical weapons components to Iran. And he argued part of his defense was to argue that he was not the only one doing business with Iran, and that to some extent he worked as a government conduit because the government wanted him to supply information on prisoners of war and so on. But the court didn't accept it, and he spent about 16 years in prison. So these things happened before. It's not the first time.
Amy, you wrote
clearly, chemical arms are more dangerous than spare parts to older generation aircraft.
You wrote a piece last month called "Who Does Israel Sell Arms To? The Defense Ministry Won't Tell." Even though most of them are already known, Israel refuses to disclose the full list of recipients. But you have a list that was in a British report. You named about 41 countries.
Well, what happened was that the British government has very open has a very open system of arms export controls. And it publishes not only stuff that Britain is selling to other countries or importing from other countries, but also third-party deals. For example, if an Israeli company wants to sell spare parts of something to a third country and it needs a British component, be it a screwdriver, a piece of software, some other equipment, it has to get end-user agreement from the British government. And the British report named all these third-party customers. Now, some of them are very well-known clients of the Israeli arms industry, like India or the United States or Britain itself. The sexier part were Muslim and Arab countries who have bought arms from Israel, like the United Arab Emirates or Egypt. And there is one thing that's controversial, was Pakistan. India has been one of Israel's largest defense customers. And when it was published when I published details from that report that Israeli companies wanted to sell spare parts to Pakistan, the Indians raised hell, and the Israeli government and the Pakistani government denied the report. But, you know, the evidence is there. These companies asked to sell spare parts to Pakistan. And, you know, there are many other customers in Latin America, in Asia, Vietnam, Singapore, and so on.
As you know, the defense industry is massive in the United States. How big is it in Israel?
It's very big. It was established since the early 50s, and it was the source of the high-tech boom in Israel was the defense industry. And Israel has been the leading exporter of systems like drones, or electronic warfare, or certain kinds of radars, cyber warfare, cyber security, and over time, these technologies and know-how transcended from the military defense sphere to the civilian sphere. And in the same way it happened in the United States when the internet was developed by the Defense Department, and now all of us are using it. And it's still one of the major export industries in Israel.
I should say weapons industries. We're speaking today with Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz, the daily liberal newspaper in Israel, and we're spending the hour with Aluf talking about everything from censorship in Israel to how issues like the BDS movement, the occupation, get covered in Israel and how they get covered here in the U.S. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. I just wanted to ask, in addition to Israel's hundreds of nuclear weapons, which never seem to get mentioned by the press, there's also, I've seen videos of intense racism against African migrants to Israel. And I was wondering if your guest could comment on that, please.
On which part? On the Africans?
Yes.
Yes.
In the past few years, tens of thousands of Africans who fled places like Eritrea and Sudan entered Israel via Egypt. And it was stopped more or less last year when the government built a fence along the Egyptian border, which is very difficult to cross. So the question was what to do with all those who have entered Israel illegally. What should be done with them? Now, Israel is part of a UN convention which forbids it from deporting these people, sending them back to where they came from, because they face persecution. In Eritrea, Sudan, they might face long prison terms or even worse, or even death. And the Netanyahu government made the fighting these asylum seekers one of the major points of its program, and we at Haaretz argued fiercely against it and argued that as long as these people enjoy this collective protection of the United Nations, rather than trying to force them out or to detain them for a long period without trial, in a prison or in what the government has called an open prison, they should be given the right to work and to live normal life for as much as possible until either the situation in their homelands is better or they find somewhere else to go. You know, they reside in mostly in an area of Tel Aviv which is near our office. We see them every day, and many of them work illegally in restaurants, in service industries. And we feel that they've been mistreated by the government, and that their sheer number is too small to make any difference on Israeli society. I mean, look at the neighboring countries like Lebanon or Jordan, who absorbed millions of refugees from Syria that have changed the demographic composition in their societies. Israel, with its 8 million citizens, can absorb 50, 60,000 Sudanese and Eritreans. It's not such a big deal. And obviously the question was, why were they mistreated because of where they came from? That's what brought forward the question of racism. But I think that it's not about racism or no racism. It's about basic human rights and basic human dignity that since these people have entered and they've been around for several years, let them live as normally as possible, and that would reduce any arguments about extreme poverty or crime involvement and so on.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Harry. Let's go next to Sherry in Boulder Creek. Hi, Sherry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a little idealistic, but you had mentioned the two-state solution, and I had wondered I don't know if anyone has thought about just making it one big, Israel, West Bank, Gaza, Palestinians, Jews, like we are all people together, and with a prime directive of mutual respect and maybe a focus on just because there's so many beautiful religions, you know, on you know, education, and I know that already happens quite. You have many amazing universities, but like to focus on that, like we're going to focus on education, not shooting each other. But
well,
and I know, I don't know, but you know, just like wait a second, okay, and let's make. When we build settlements, let's build them for everybody, and we can. I mean, I don't mean the violent people. The violent people can go off into the desert and kill each other, but but you know, I mean, there are many people in. I read and saw a documentary of Israelis and how, you know, the young people and most of the people in the country, they don't want war, and all the Palestinians, the people who, you know, husbands, wives, and children and young people, they don't want war. So we have a machine that's like making it all keep going. And I'm ashamed to say that my country is a real big part of that, and the money sent over and the missiles sent over, but I digress. I'm kind of, is anybody maybe thinking that we could get together on this, and our centered thing is we can, you know, here's the Muslim religion, here's the Jewish religion, here's the Christian religion. Let's study our past and come together, because it's people have been there. I mean, I don't need to tell you. Forgive me. You know,
Sherry, thanks for calling. I'm sorry I have to cut you off, but we have a number of callers on the line. Let me just go through a few more callers, and then let me just say one thing
about it. This is, interestingly, this is the position of both the far right and the far left in Israel, who both oppose partition and support the one state for different reasons. I don't think it's really practical, because for the past 25 years, or even more, there has been growing disconnection between the two societies, and deep, deep schisms of enmity and bad blood were built. And I don't think it would be very useful or easy to try and overcome it and build this utopian one society. I think partition is still the better option.
Gregory writes in, he wants to know if Israel is becoming even more right-wing.
It's, look, the right-wing has been in power in Israel since 1977, most of the time. And so that's the, most of the years that Israel has existed. The question is, what does it mean to be more right-wing? Because some positions have changed. Netanyahu, who is the prime minister and the leader of the right-wing, is now calling for a Palestinian state. 30 years ago, it wasn't even the position of the left-wing, or only the far left. So the definition of right and left is changing. But I think the most important change within Israeli society that is often overlooked from the outside is the changing demography of Israel, and the rise of the two minority groups who were in the political and social fringe for many years, namely the Arabic speakers and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, both of whom are not Zionist in their politics, and both are exempt from military service and are underemployed. And today, among first and second grade kids in Israel, half belong to these minorities. And no matter, and immigration out of Israel is mostly of seculars and not of Arabs or ultra-Orthodox Jews. So if you extrapolate and you look forward, a very different Israeli society is being built and is driven from the maternity ward, not by outside immigration like in the past. And this is where, if you want to look at the future of Israel, this is where you should look at. And the current government is a government, it's a coalition of the mainstream parties pushing aside the minorities and trying to make all kinds of legislation to make minority life harder in Israel. And I don't think it's going to work.
Why do you think Netanyahu keeps getting elected? And do you feel like there is a strong left opposition?
Well, Netanyahu keeps getting elected because he's a very successful politician. And because under his rule, the country is quiet. The external conflict with Palestinians, with the neighboring state, has been the most quiet under Netanyahu. So it's for a reason. Netanyahu is very reluctant to use military force. He might, it's like, I think his mentor in America was Ronald Reagan. Netanyahu was here and he came of age politically when he was ambassador during the Reagan years in America. And he adapted more or less Reagan's both economic and foreign policy. And the foreign policy is, talk big about force and using it, but don't actually use it. And people appreciate that because the economy is booming and there's a relatively small number of military-related funerals. The other reason is that we don't see an alternative. When you look at the Israeli political scene, and it's been polled time and again in the past 5 years, it's Netanyahu and the umpteen dwarfs. And there's no challenger to Netanyahu either within his party, within the coalition, or in the opposition. As for the left-wing opposition in Israel, 2.5 years ago, for the first time, we saw massive social protest in Israel that was focused on domestic issues, not on peace and war, but on the rising cost of living and prices of food staples or real estate. And Netanyahu was shrewd enough to simply to push it aside and keep on with his Reaganist policies. Economic policies. There is a vocal left-wing opposition in Israel that is growing, but the center-left, to the extent that it exists, is siding with Netanyahu. They still see Netanyahu as the better option and as the only one who could bring peace with the Palestinians, because Netanyahu's power is such that any deal that he would bring to the table would enjoy enormous support, both in parliament and within the Israeli public.
What happened to that protest movement? And I remember a lot of young people were camping out in Tel Aviv.
It disappeared. People returned to some of the leaders of the protest movement were elected to the Knesset, mainly in the Labor Party. And others came back to their regular life. Prices of real estate and food staples are still very high in Israel. And the government was simply smart enough to absorb it. And I think that the failure of the protest movement was that it was trying to be very mainstream. Or in other words, it said we have growing social gaps in Israel. We lost the egalitarianism of our founders, and we lost the welfare state, and we need to rebuild it. But they were focused on, taxing the rich, other than having a second look at the priorities at the expense side. Now, the expense side under the Netanyahu government has three main goals: increasing the defense budget, building more settlements in the West Bank, and funding the ultra-Orthodox school system and subsidizing it rather than sending these people to the job market. And the protesters, because they wanted to be apolitical and not appear to be a bunch of left-wing radicals, as the government tried to portray them, simply ignore the expense side. Now, let's say you're taxing the rich, but if you're spending more money on these priorities, then you're making the problem worse rather than solving it. And the new Netanyahu government is sticking to the same set of priorities as its predecessor.
We're speaking with Aluf Ben, editor-in-chief of Haaretz, the daily liberal newspaper in Israel. And we have time for just a few more calls. Let's hear from Andre in San Francisco. Hi, Andre. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Rose, and thank you very much to the guest. About 6 months ago, I heard a report on NPR about the Israeli defense report, the IDF technique of going into a Palestinian home in the middle of the night, telling them to get their children dressed and that they're taking their kids in to get updated ID cards. The whole family is traumatized. And then the officers say, oh, no, we're not going to do it tonight. Could you please comment on whether or not that's getting any airplay, those types of techniques are getting any airplay in the public media in Israel?
That specific story I can't recall, but that can, well, we publish a lot of this kind of stories at Haaretz, and occasionally it filters to the wider audience, mainstream media as well, especially when human rights groups offer videos to the TV channels. Then it gains more traction, and people are more aware of that.
And Amir Haas and Gideon Levy write about these issues on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah.
About life under occupation.
And we cover it all the time.
Well, Amir Haas was in the U.S. last April. She wrote a column called The Inner Syntax of Palestinian Stone Throwing. And she got slammed for this column. Does this happen on a regular basis to Amir Haas and Gideon Levy for what they write about?
Yes, but you know, in that op-ed piece, she wrote that throwing stones is both a birthright and the duty of people under occupation. And the Yesha Council, the settler movement, published on their website, they published my email and urged people to write emails to me, and I got like 250 emails condemning the article and arguing that we support deadly terrorist acts by Palestinians and so on. Interestingly, we got zero reaction from our own readers to that. And it exposed the divide within Israeli society. To our readers, this was something that they could absorb and live with and understand. I think it was a very smart piece because it really tried to explain the reasons behind Palestinian stone throwing, while at the same time it's been very, very critical of the Palestinian youth themselves and saying that most of it is a product of, you know, adolescent hormones rather than any serious political platform. But obviously all those detractors from the right wing ignored that part of the article.
Well, in her piece she wrote, Israelis remain in denial about, quote, how much violence is used on a daily basis against Palestinians. They don't like to be told that someone has the right to resist their violence, end quote. And we'll put a link to that piece on our website right after the show. Let's go, and I know we're going to talk quickly. You wanted to add one more thing about censorship of freedom of the press?
Yeah, I wanted to say that in Israel we don't have the First Amendment. There is no law in Israel. We don't have a constitution at all, but we don't have any law in Israel protecting the freedom of the press or the freedom of expression. All we have is a collection, an assortment of Supreme Court rulings over that matter. So it's a fight that we must fight day in and day out. Libel laws in Israel are more like the British model, far more draconian than here. That's the downside. On the upside here, you have to remember one thing. Israelis go through military service. So when you need to report about military affairs, many people know these things from their own experience. They know, everybody in Israel knows military secrets. And it's very different than a society where the military is a closed group of volunteers, like in the United States or in Western Europe.
Aluf Ben is editor-in-chief of Haaretz, a daily liberal newspaper in Israel. He's also served as the paper's diplomatic editor, and he is a regular contributor to The Guardian. Aluf, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. It's Your Call. What are the economics behind the meat and dairy industries? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with David Robinson Simon, author of Meatonomics, The Bizarre Economics of Meat and Dairy. The book explores the effects the meat and dairy industries have on taxpayers, animals, and the environment. Every year, Americans eat 200 pounds of meat per person. So who are the major players in these industries, and what are the hidden costs? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.